We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about microfinance. Now, this is a term that is applied to programs that provide financial services to poor people. And supporters of the whole project of microfinance say that programs like this make it possible, for example, to lend people money. These people can borrow money, small amounts, use it to do things like start small businesses and raise their standard of living. Now, there are others who do argue there is a downside to microfinance. They say microloans may not help with the serious problems that poor people have, things like access to health care and education, and may, in fact, saddle people with loans that they can't repay. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll try to talk about the pros and cons of microfinance. And our guest for the program is Chris Bold. He is a microfinance specialist with the consultative group, or maybe you say consultative group, to assist the poor, maybe more easily and commonly known by its initials, CGAP. It's housed at the World Bank in Washington, D.C., and he is part of CGAP's technology team. He's worked on projects in a lot of places around the world, Haiti, Pakistan, and Kenya. These places particularly, he's working on projects that use new technologies, things like mobile phones, to expand access to financial services. He also leads research on how government payments, things like welfare payments and pensions, can be used to promote financial inclusion. Before going to work at CGAP, he worked for the UK government's Department for International Development, where he worked for 3 years, most recently in Afghanistan. He's also worked in Sierra Leone. He holds a bachelor's degree in science from Cambridge and master's degree in development and social policy from the London School of Economics. And he is joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased that he could spend some time with us. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. We just ask people to try and be brief so we could keep moving along, but questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's the number to use if it would be a long-distance call. We'll pay for the call. You also can send along your comments by email, so you can write to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, your questions are welcome. And Chris Bold, hello.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for having me on the show today.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. Maybe the thing to do here just at the beginning is for me to ask you to talk a little bit more about CGAP and what it's all about.
Sure, absolutely. CGAP is a policy and research center. You might think of us as a bit like a think tank. We're housed inside the World Bank, but we're funded by 30 donors. And we work on issues like setting standards for microfinance and looking at new innovations that the sector as a whole might take up that can reduce costs and expand access.
Mm-hmm. And just I want to make sure that we're clear here on your relationship with the World Bank. The World Bank, they're not determining what it is that you're doing or having any impact they're not directing the programs that you all are involved with?
That's right. We have 30 donors. There are a number of bilateral donors like the U.S. government, the U.K. government, and the French government, some of the foundations like the Ford Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation who support us, and we have a sort of separate governance structure. The World Bank is one of our donors as well, and we physically sit within the World Bank.
All right. I think that people, I think now will be acquainted with the idea of microfinance. It is something that has become something of a movement. People believe that it can be a very useful tool for development. The basic idea being, again, that we have people who, because they're poor, lenders don't see them as particularly attractive customers. So they're people who don't have access to financial services. Loans are part of it, but that's perhaps just one part of it.
That's right. There's an important distinction between microfinance and microcredit, which is what you're describing there. So we think that, like you and me, poor people need access to a wide variety of financial services. So that might be somewhere safe to store money if you're saving up to invest in a business or you want to put a child into school or university. You might need to borrow money to invest in property. or in case there's a medical emergency in your family, you might need insurance in case your crop fails this year. Or you might just want to send money to a relative that lives in a different country. So I think we all take these financial services for granted, but many poor people just don't have access to these or their informal services that they can use, which tend to be very expensive and are less safe. Mm-hmm. So we're interested in how we promote this whole package of financial services. Credit's an important part, but it's not the only part.
Well, it seems that at least recently, as people have started to raise some questions, that's the thing that they're focusing on is credit. And, you know, perhaps the best known institution of this nature in the entire world probably is the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. That was founded back in the mid-70s by a man named Muhammad Yunus. And he and the bank were honored for their work with the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. So it seems that for a long time, the reaction to this sort of thing was very positive. And just recently, some questions have started to be raised, particularly, again, about the idea that people might get themselves into trouble borrowing money, even if it's small amounts of money, that they have a difficult time paying back. And just recently, for example, there's been a lot of reporting on what's going on in India, which I think traditionally has been one of the places where microfinance has been biggest, with a lot of people getting into a downward spiral of debt, borrowing money, not being able to pay it back, borrowing more, and getting into very serious financial difficulty.
That's right. I mean, as you say, the iconic story from Muhammad Yunus's institution, the Grameen Bank, which means village bank, is of lending this small amount of money to a poor woman who couldn't get access to a loan from anywhere else. But actually, the Grameen Bank does offer a wide variety of services. They offer savings products as well, which many people think is needed at least as much as credit, that safe place to store money. In India, you're right, we've seen alarming rates of debt there. In fact, in one state in particular, in Andhra Pradesh, the median household has four loans. They're taking those from a variety of different institutions. And it seems that this focus on just one product, on credit, has caused big problems in that state.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I know your organization has a set of principles that you think are very important that people keep in mind when it comes to microfinance. What just to take that for example, this admittedly we're focusing a lot on microcredit, but what seems to have gone wrong there, or did something go wrong there?
Yeah, well, something clearly has gone wrong there. I mean, if we just take Andhra Pradesh, the average debt per family there is $1,400, which is more than the average annual income. So it seems that people have been borrowing large amounts of money. That's four times more than the average level of debt in any other state. So it seems that credit has been very readily available there, has maybe been pushed by institutions at the expense of other products that might actually be better suited to poor people's needs. And there really hasn't been the focus on educating customers about how to be, how to determine what level of debt they should be taking on. India has a vibrant microfinance sector that's really taken off in Andhra Pradesh. There's also government-directed self-help groups, which have also been lending, and a lot of people have been borrowing from traditional informal money lenders in the villages, which are sometimes referred to as loan sharks as well. So families have taken on debt from these different groups without perhaps understanding the full implications of that and thinking about their ability to repay those loans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would imagine that the lenders would be subject to some kind of regulation on the state level and perhaps also on the national level, looking at things like how much interest they can charge and other various sorts of things that regulate the way they operate. Is this a problem with regulation?
Well, the state government has in the last week or so introduced new ordinance, which is regulation at a state level, that's making it very difficult for microfinance institutions. They've restricted the number of places at which MFIs are allowed to collect on their loans, and they've introduced interest rate caps. The challenge that we see with interest rate caps is that it is very expensive reaching out to some of these very remote rural areas. And if interest rate caps are introduced that are too low, then the microfinance institutions just won't serve those areas. So there's been a mixed experience with whether interest rate caps are a good way of tackling this problem. And an alternative is to force MFIs to be just very transparent in explaining to customers what interest rate it is that they're charging. So in the US, for example, there are strong consumer protection laws, but those laws don't exist in some countries like India.
Yeah. Well, in passing, you touched on one of the questions I think that's raised about microfinance, and that is, given the kind of customer base they serve, the cost of serving them, and the potential risk for again, going back to microcredit, for the possibility that people might default on loans, if you look at all of that, you could say, well, it's reasonable to think that you could operate successfully in a city, for example, where you have a lot of people to draw on as potential customers. Much more difficult to think about being able to have an operation like that in a rural area. It's again, simply because your customer base just isn't going to be what it's going to be in a big city. How do you think about that very question of where it's actually possible to operate?
That's a great question. I mean, that's one of the driving questions that our team, the technology team at CGAP, is thinking about. We're interested in how you can use new technology to really bring down those costs so that you can reach into some of these areas that it just wasn't viable to reach before. So around the world, we estimate that there are about 2.7 billion people that still don't have any access to formal financial services. And some work that we did with the GSM Association, which is an industry body for mobile phone operators, suggest that a billion of those people have already got mobile phones. So we're interested in looking at whether we can use technology like mobile phones, like the devices that you use in restaurants to swipe your card, can be used to enable us to offer financial services in much more remote areas that we haven't been able to reach before.
I'd say that's an interesting concept, and I'm sure a lot of people would say, well, that's a great goal, though does that mean that there's never going to be personal contact between the customer and the institution, or maybe limited personal contact?
Well, this is more than just a goal. I mean, we're really seeing this take off in countries like Kenya. In Kenya, there's a service called M-Pesa, M for mobile and Pesa being Swahili for money. And this is an account that's offered on a mobile phone. And now more than one in two adults have got this account on their phone. The way it works is that you visit one of the agents where you would go to buy airtime for your phone, and you can deposit cash there or make a withdrawal from your account on your phone. So there's still that human interaction. You could think of these agents as akin to a human ATM where you can both deposit and withdraw cash. And this is really changing the landscape in Kenya, and a lot of other countries are taking note of what's going on there and looking at whether this is a model that might be able to take off in their country.
So is it really the case in a lot of places that people lack such a basic service as someplace safe to keep their money so that it will be safe, perhaps earn a little interest for them, that they'll be able to have ready access to it, you know, something that's an alternative to putting it into a box and putting it under your bed?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the microfinance community has focused too much on credit in the past at the expense of savings. And there's a lot of research that suggests that poor people need a safe place to save, as you've described it, an alternative to the mattress, more than they need access to a loan. These two are intimately related, though, because microfinance institutions that are able to gather deposits, that's a very cheap way of getting the money that they lend out. So by collecting deposits locally, they're probably able to reduce the rate at which they lend that money as well.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Chris Bold. He works as a microfinance specialist with the Consultative Group to Assist the Poor, CGAP. It's based in Washington, D.C. They're housed at the World Bank. This is an independent policy and research center that's interested in advancing financial access to the world's poor. And as he just said, it's been estimated that something like 2.7 billion people around the world do not have access to basic financial services. As we have discussed, a lot of the focus talking about microfinance reliance has been on loans, has been on microcredit, but we're also talking about things like savings and the ability to put your money someplace where it will be safe, but also where you will have ready access, and then an institution that then can turn around and lend that money out. The group we're talking about, CGAP, it's supported by many development agencies and private foundations from around the world that's interested in this particular issue, that is, trying to get at poverty this way. Our guest, Chris Bold, he works on projects in Haiti, Pakistan, and Kenya that, as he explained, they're using new technologies, things like mobile phones, to expand access to financial services. He's also worked in Sierra Leone. Questions here, questions, comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, there seem to be, continue to be some rather basic questions about microfinance, and I think that for a long time the argument was made that it's something that actually can really help poor people raise themselves up, raise their standard of living in a variety of ways. And I think also some people, though, have said, well, that's we have anecdotal evidence for that. And that's what everybody likes to think, but that we, you know, if you ask the question, well, does microfinance really help reduce poverty? It seems that we don't have a ready answer for that question. Do you feel that there is an answer to that question?
That is a big question. There's a lot of research being done at the moment to try and address that question. One way that microfinance might help poor people is exactly as you've described, to allow them to invest in a business. Another way that people use financial services is to allow them to manage their cash flow over time. So, for example, if there's an emergency, being able to borrow for healthcare costs or something like that. So there's an argument that microfinance can be very useful for consumption smoothing over time as well. And there's emerging behavioral research which suggests that when poor people aren't preoccupied by these immediate cash flow problems, they're allowed to think more long-term and to plan for the future. So the evidence from some of these big randomized control trials that are taking place in India is will start to come back very soon, and we'll all be interested in seeing the results from that. I think that everybody that works in microfinance has met people that they can categorically say have benefited from having access to microfinance services, but it'll be good to get the results back from these more rigorous scientific surveys.
All right, let's talk with a listener here, someone listening in Champaign. Line number one is the caller. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I was very distressed to hear recently that microfinance was in such a dither. I heard a couple of reports on the BBC. And I've been supporting for years an organization that used to be Meals for Millions, and now it's called Freedom from Hunger. And also recently another one that I support, Right Sharing of World Resources. Their model is to give an initial grant to a small group, usually of women, and then that grant becomes a revolving loan and circulates in the group. And the women are required to join a little cooperative where they help each other, and they also get instruction on how to manage money in different ways. So they educate them about money. Whereas when commercial banks go in, I don't think there's an initial grant. So that's a slightly different model. And then another model I know of, which is a friend of mine helps Mexican expatriates who live in a nearby town, and they have sort of a club where they pool their money, and every member gives a certain amount every week, and then one member gets the take for that week. So it's kind of like a revolving layaway fund, sort of. So would you care to comment on either of those?
Yeah, I mean, those are two models you've described. There are a huge number of different models out there. You described a rotating savings and loans club and a group loan. Some also do individual loans, and then there's other groups that focus on different products. I mean, we think that the best thing for customers is if they have access to a huge variety of different credit products, much like you do. I mean, you probably get bombarded with credit card applications through the mail, and you have a choice about which of those products you take on. So that's the best position for a customer to be in. I think that at the moment what we're seeing is the focus of the world press on a small number of institutions that have are seeing problems, and an even smaller number that may have used aggressive practices to collect on loans or things like that. But I don't think that this is true of the sector as a whole, and it sounds like the group that you're supporting is being very responsible in the way it's educating customers and in the products that it's offering to them.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. When you look at the people who are in this business, the providers of financial services to poor people, how many of them are for profits and how many of them are nonprofits? Is that possible to say?
I'm sure it is. I don't have those figures to hand, but I'm sure that would be available on our website. As you say, there are a huge variety of actors, ranging from those that are entirely socially motivated to those that also expect to see some sort of return, either protection of their capital or a commercial return. One of the big advantages of microfinance compared to some other development interventions is that it can be rolled out to huge numbers of people. I mean, tens or hundreds of millions of people, without the need for huge amounts of subsidy. So that's been one of the things that's made microfinance very attractive to both institutional donors and to individuals who want to contribute, like your last caller.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about the issue of interest rates and whether or not it makes sense that they are capped or at what level. And I know that there, again, have people who made this argument that, well, if you cap the rates, depending on where you set the cap, that it makes it gets to the point where you can't operate because you're not covering your costs. And you have to be able to do that whether you're a nonprofit or a for-profit. What I have seen is that interest rates tend to be, maybe in the low, averaging in the low 20s, although that there are some that can be much higher. And that may actually be attractive to people if the alternative is going to some kind of private market where rates can also be very high and security is much less. What is the average figure for interest rates charged on micro loans?
Well, if we take loans in Andhra Pradesh, the state in India we were talking about earlier where there's been a lot of focus, interest rates have been in the order of 24% to 48%, but the microfinance organizations there have agreed voluntarily to drop their rates to below 24%. Now, most of these institutions themselves, have to borrow money that they lend to clients, and they have to pay a cost to borrow that money. So they're probably paying over 10% already of that away to the bank or to the organization that they borrow that money from. What we have seen across the globe is that interest rates have been dropping on average by about 2.3% a year. So part of that is the introduction of new technology, both at the back end, so better systems, and at the front end. We talked earlier about the use of mobile phones, for example, to record the loans that are going out and to help recollect payments.
Is there also an issue, or has there been an issue with other kinds of, say, service charges that fees that people are assessed just to do business?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the point that we were discussing earlier about the need for transparency. Mm-hmm. Customers need to understand what the product is that they're signing up for. Is there an upfront fee? What's the interest rate? Is there a penalty for repaying early? Is there going to be a grace period if they miss one loan? So transparency and clear messages about how the product is priced is something that we have been pushing for a long time.
Maybe I should just take the moment here to introduce again our guest, Chris Bold. He's a microfinance specialist. He works in the technology team at the Consultative Group to Assist the Poor. CGAP is the initials, a little easier to say it that way. They're based in Washington, D.C. They're housed at the World Bank. This is a policy and research center interested in this whole issue of financial access to the world's poor. It's supported by a number of different development agencies and also private foundations who work on this particular issue. And he himself, Chris Bold, has worked on projects in Haiti and Pakistan and Kenya that do something that he's talked about, and that is they use new technologies, things like mobile phones, to expand people's access to financial services. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Pakistan, and I know that this here is a place where you think that there's been significant success have a program that involves a lot of people. You know, talk a little bit about what's happened there.
Yeah, we've got a really exciting project in Pakistan. Let me just set a bit of context here. So Pakistan is a country with just shy of 200 million people, and there's only about 10,000 bank branches in the entire country. So it's very difficult for people to get to a bank branch, and because of that, only around 12% of people have a bank account or any access to any form of financial services. We're working with a small microfinance organization that's partnered with one of the big mobile phone operators there. Now, this phone operator has 150,000 different outlets where people can get top-up for their phones. And what we've helped them to do is to convert 10,000 of those into places where people can put money into an account or withdraw money. So people with a mobile phone can go to one of these agents, we call them, and they can sign up for an account on their phone, and then they can use their phone account in much the same way that we use our bank accounts as somewhere safe to store money and withdraw it when they need it.
And does the phone company make money on these transactions?
They do, so it's free to put your money in, and the way they make money is that they get a very small fee when you send money to another user or when you withdraw your money, and those rates are down at around the 1% mark.
Mm. I suppose there again, the key to your financial success, if that's what you do, is big volume. If you get enough people to do enough transactions, then the transaction fee for the individual can be relatively low, but you could make significant amounts of money if you could get enough business.
That's exactly right. So, again, looking at Kenya, where the most advanced service operates, they've now got 12 million customers there. And they've now made back their investment that they put in to roll out this service. This is another mobile phone company. And they charge less than half a U.S. dollar for each transaction. And people love this service because it makes it possible for them to send money back to their families who maybe live in the village in a remote rural area. And before, they had to rely on the bus driver to take a brown envelope stuffed full of cash, or they had to use expensive money transfer operators because the vast majority of them don't have bank accounts. And even if they do, their relative who lives in a remote village wouldn't be able to get to a bank themselves.
Mm. And in this particular program you were talking about in Pakistan, I think that Harriet Williamson, my producer, said that there's 500,000 people now who are involved in that. As customers, I mean.
That's right. Well, we've seen, I think, more than 5 million people now who've made a transaction using the service. So they're using it to pay their bills. They're using it to send money to friends and family. And some of them are starting to, trust the service enough to store their money there. And the service has only been around for a year now.
Oh, that's a pretty that's fairly impressive growth for something that's been in business for just that short a time.
That's right.
And maybe the thing that I'm thinking of is with the half was that half of the clients are women?
Ah, it sounds like you might be talking about Afghanistan.
Oh, I've got my countries mixed up here. All right.
Yeah, so I, as you know, I worked in Afghanistan for some time, and I really think that the microfinance sector there is one of the success stories that doesn't get enough airplay.
Mm-hmm.
In 2001, there was no sector at all, and a number of institutions have built up. They now offer savings and loan products to 500,000 people in that country. It's a country of about 30 million, so that's pretty impressive growth. And over half of those clients are women who have a safe place to store their money or are investing in their own small businesses.
The thing I guess I was going to what seems to be interesting, and it seems to be the case no matter where you go, is that the main client for microfinance is a woman, and people who are in the business of micro lending and maybe doing other kinds of microfinance, they actually seem to think that their ideal client is a woman.
Well, this is probably a product of two things. Firstly, that women have been traditionally excluded, so there's probably greater pent-up demand there amongst women clients. And secondly, especially through these group loan products, people have shown that women make excellent customers. They're, you know, very good at repaying on time. And so obviously institutions are more keen to lend to people where they are confident that they will get that money back.
That's the, I guess that was the thing that I read, that perhaps they were a little bit more responsible than the men when it came to making sure that the loans were used in a constructive manner and that they were paid back.
Right. Some microfinance institutions certainly believe that and have built their business models around it and serve either entirely or predominantly women clients. Others you know, take a different approach and will offer loans to both men or women.
I think that there are people who believe that very strongly that institutions that are involved in this business should indeed be private institutions. And not to say that there's not a role for government and NGOs to do that. But that that they should primarily be private institutions. And I guess for me a question that comes up in my mind is, well, why can't government do this, or can governments do this, or do you think in fact that it's something that is actually better done by the private sector?
Again, that's a good question. I mean, we do see in different countries governments taking different approaches. Some governments try to encourage a private sector, some promote NGOs, and some try to do lending themselves. Often governments aren't set up, they just don't have the reach of access points across the country to be able to effectively offer credit or savings products, and they don't see this as their business. In other countries, the state-run banks do have that reach across the country. So it depends from country to country whether that mix of private, for-profit, NGOs, typically non-profit organizations, and government institutions. Again, we think that the best proposition for the client is when they've got a choice of different products and they can choose what loan they might want to take or who they trust to save their money with. Hmm.
We have a caller here in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Yes. As admirable as some of the Grameen projects have been, it seems to me that the micro has to account with the macro at some point. You were talking earlier about the catastrophic results in India, and particularly that one province. My understanding is that these are mainly cotton farmers. The suicide rates are extremely high, and it's a debt trap phenomena. And what I mean by the macro is, what do we know about the price of cotton? Not much, except we know it's subsidized here. There's a structural problem in the world economy that the World Bank has been participating in for quite a while, and not at your level, but of the raw inputs, the lesser developed countries sell are always lower valued. And it's basically criminal to my mind. I'm not being I'm a little feverish today. I wasn't going to call, but I think this point of view gets short shrift. It's not spoken of too much in the hallowed halls of the World Bank, that very expensive marble building in D.C. But the people, many people in the world know these facts, and it's a mounting problem. It shows up in what we call terrorism, but the disaffection with the current economic system, as we see now, is not even limited to lesser developed countries, the periphery of Europe and soon the center, and maybe there'll even be an uprising here. But obviously, this is not the micro focus of this particular show. But I thought it was worthy of at least some mention. And I don't know how Grameen really fits with the suicide of the cotton farmers in India. The cotton is a big product in Pakistan as well, and obviously. I don't expect any agreement from from the World Bank technologists, but I was just putting it out into the broader broader field of discourse. Thanks.
Okay. Well, you can comment on that any way you like.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, there's a number of complex interconnected issues there. I mean, I can't really comment with any authority on the link between agricultural subsidies in the US and Europe and the sort of macroeconomic position in India. As you say, the suicides that we've seen in Andhra Pradesh are tragic, and the authorities there are investigating whether over-indebtedness has been part of the cause of that. And, you know, any microfinance institutions that have been seen to be operating outside of the law hopefully will, you know, face the consequences of that if that is shown to have been the case. There's no doubt that it was in part the sort of economic downturn that tipped this house of cards in India. We had... as I mentioned at the beginning of this program, very, very high levels of debt amongst all the families in this province, with an average of 4 loans per family. And when there was an economic decline in Andhra Pradesh, and it's not clear exactly what factors caused that, that meant that a lot of people all of a sudden had trouble repaying those loans. So there is a clear link between the macroeconomic and the microeconomic. I'm much more comfortable commenting on what's going on at the micro level.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Chris Bold is our guest. He's a microfinance specialist. He works in the technology team at the Consultative Group to Assist the Poor, CGAP. The initials, that's a little easier way to say it. They're housed at the World Bank in Washington. This is an independent policy and research center. They're interested in advancing financial access to poor people around the world. It's supported by over 30 development agencies and private foundations who have this as their poverty alleviation, have that as their mission. Before going to work to CGAP, he worked for the government of the UK, where their Department for International Development, and he's worked there for 3 years. He most recently in Afghanistan. He's now working on projects in Haiti, Pakistan, and Kenya that use new technologies, things like mobile phones, to expand access to financial services. And questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send an email to us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me just ask you something else, because I think, again, they're one of the kind of conflicts or points of debate within microfinance has to do with whether or not lenders have any right or responsibility to look at what people are proposing to do with the money and then make their decisions on whether they want to lend or whether they want to provide financial services based on that. And so if, for example, again, going back to microcredit, there were some people who would say, well, if people wanted to borrow money to start a small business, well, that would be a good thing. But maybe other things they might want to borrow money for would not be considered to be such a good thing. So I suppose that gets to the question that do you think that there is some obligation in some way for these institutions to, at the very least, do some kind of basic financial education, and that is to raise some questions or work with people and get them to think about what it is they do with their money? Or do you think that essentially it's just a matter of they should stand back and have hands off, and as long as someone meets particular qualifications for a loan, for example, they should get the loan, and it shouldn't be any real business of the lender what the person's going to use that money for?
Well, there are different approaches to this question taken by different institutions. So some of those that want to lend primarily for business will invest a lot of time in providing, for example, basic business training in how to keep books, training around marketing, and help clients to think through their business model before they lend to them. At the other end of the spectrum, we have microfinance institutions that think that it's okay to just lend to clients who, you know, may not want to invest this money in a business at all. They might be borrowing to pay for school fees for a child, or somebody might be wanting to take a short-term loan because a family member's has got sick. At the end of the day, you know, a household has access to different sources of funding, and money is fungible. So you may think that you're lending for one thing, but that money might end up being used for something else. And there's a question about how much the institution can control that.
Well, I imagine at the end of the day, the institution can't really have much control over that at all. And unless you have some sort of issue with people saying they're going to do one thing and then doing something else, I'm not sure that there is much opportunity for an institution to have control like that.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, there's a question about whether it's a good thing to try and control that, whether that's going to help your repayment rates, or whether you should just accept that fact and worry more about whether customers have been able to repay their loans in the past.
Yeah, I guess I'm continuing to think about, you know, how it is where people like you are trying to assess the pros and cons here, and again thinking about it, seemed like for such a long time we said with almost without reservation that this was good, and just only fairly recently, and maybe that has something to do with the economic conditions around the world, but maybe it seems like only recently has anybody begun to question this.
I think there have been you know, questions raised in a number of markets where we've seen customers taking on a lot of debt. You know, these questions have been raised not just in developing countries, but also in developed countries. And, you know, we've seen people in the U.S. who have been offered loans, mortgages, auto loans, credit cards, where they haven't really understood the products that they've been taking on. And, you know, these problems are coming home to roost now in the U.S. So these problems have been around for a while. I think we've, you know, in any sector, there are always going to be a couple of unscrupulous organizations that will try and make profits by not by disguising some of the features of the product. But I think that the majority of the sector, especially the microfinance sector, where so many people that are involved in it, really are motivated by the poverty reduction potential. I think that it's important that we don't color the whole sector you know, based on the experience with a couple of organizations that have, or a couple of parts of the world where we're seeing these problems. The biggest challenge that we face out there is that there are still 2.7 billion people that don't have any access to financial services at all, and this far outweighs the challenge in a couple of places where people have actually been offered too many loans, for example.
Mm-hmm. That's, I would think that for some international financial enterprises, they might look at that and say, well, 2.7 billion potential customers, there's the possibility of making money there. And that if you can make a system, you know, the system of branchless banking work, where people are using mobiles and using that as their instrument to deposit or move around money, and if that can be shown to work, Is there concern that that some large international financial institutions will say, well, here there's an opportunity for us to make money, not necessarily that that's a bad thing, but that they might move aggressively into markets like this, and that might cause problems?
Well, I think we're already seeing a lot of commercial actors moving into this that are motivated both by the potential they see to make money and also by the potential they see to offer services that poor people or the mass market in these countries will welcome. So we're aware of nearly 100 different mobile banking deployments around the world. We've talked on this program about the huge success we've seen in Kenya and a project that we're supporting in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. You know, these organizations are able to undercut the existing banking sector, reach customers that weren't reached before, offer services that are cheaper than were previously offered, and they're able to do all of that and still make a commercial return. So I think we welcome those sort of actors into the microfinance arena, but we think that customers needed to be adequately protected, mm-hmm. and we continue to push for transparent services that customers can easily understand and compare.
And just to pick up on one point there, though, is there concern that perhaps existing local domestic financial institutions are not going to be able to compete, and that you might, if you have a domestic financial sector like that, it might actually be damaged, and in the long run, that might necessarily be so good for the economy of that country.
Well, in a lot of countries, we see domestic organizations taking the lead. I mean, let's talk about Pakistan again, where the microfinance institution that we're working with that's offering this branch, this banking service, is a Pakistani MFI. And the other big branch, this banking service that's being used by the government to deliver flood relief payments, is one of the largest four banks in Pakistan, is 100% Pakistani owned. So it's not just the sort of international private sector, as it were, that's interested in this opportunity, but also the domestic private sector in these countries. And again, you know, with 2.7 billion people unserved, we think there's huge untapped potential there. And it's not a case of, you know, who will serve these people. There's plenty of room for all of these different actors to get involved.
All right, let's talk with a caller in Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Hello. I'm a little confused about the mechanics, because I've got two interpretations and they fit everything, so one of them's got to be wrong. Could you explain to me exactly the use of the phone? Is that just moving money from one, you know, part of the bank to another, or do you actually go to a place like an ATM, we would call it here, do some things with your phone, all of a sudden money pops out on the machine? Is that what's going on? And if so, I'd be concerned about, well, in the long run, the Taliban taking these babies over, as far as that goes. I wonder if you can make some comments about the mechanics of the use of that phone for the individual people and over there. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So let me describe the service as it works in Kenya, and it's a similar model that's being adopted in Pakistan. But in Kenya, what happens is you have a bank account on your phone. You visit one of – they have about 25,000 agents there. So an agent is a guy who runs a shop. Perhaps he sells airtime. He might sell you know, agricultural products or something like that. But he's got a small shop that he runs, and he also has a mobile phone. You can go into that shop and you can deposit your money. Let's say you want to deposit $10, and you hand over the money to the agent, and he enters a few commands into his phone, and it credits it to your account. You get a message on your phone to say that that money has landed in your account. You can then leave the store, and you can send that money from your phone to other friends or relatives, and then they can do the procedure in reverse. They go into the agent. They initiate a transaction on their mobile phone. The agent gets a text message to instruct him to hand over the money, and he gives you the cash. Now, the question about whether this type of service could be used for, money laundering or the financing of terrorism, or whether criminal or even terrorist groups, you know, might be able to use these services, is one that, you know, a number of people have raised. But actually, I think that most of the security enforcement organizations think that this is actually a really good thing, because at the moment, money passes around completely anonymously. They use the hawala system, or they, you know, send it in unmarked envelopes, and there's absolutely no way of tracing that cash. Well, if the money is being sent using these formal systems, then the money can be traced. We know which account it's moving from, who people are sending it to, and even better, because it's on a mobile phone, you can actually trace where the money's being sent. So I think that the prevailing opinion is that moving people from the informal sector and bringing them sort of out of the shadows and into formal systems like this is good for clients, but it's also good for combating money laundering and financing of terrorism.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that though there are still a lot of important issues, things like the possibility of fraud, of people being damaged, who has access to information about people and their financial information, this essentially the same things that apply, I suppose, to people who are doing banking anywhere.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you have to compare what's happening now to the services that people were using before. So on the one hand, there's a, you know, banking sector which in a lot of these countries probably only covers 10 or 20% of people. The services they're actually using are informal services. They're going to the money lender, or they're using the hawala system to send money around. So are new systems better than those informal systems that existed before.
And I imagine that in some of these countries that they don't have much, if anything, in the way of consumer protection laws or some agencies who are responsible for overseeing that sort of thing.
Well, that's a big field where we're doing a lot of work in thinking about how best to protect consumers. In Kenya, for example, this mobile banking service operates under the same regulation that the banking sector operates under. So they're very clear about, you know, they make sure that in every agent location there's a poster that gives all of the prices, and that's made very clear. And if agents are seen to, you know, not be sticking to those pricing, then those agents are summarily dismissed.
Well, we're just about at the point where we have to finish up. This is something I'm sure that we'll continue to develop, and perhaps we can continue to watch and talk about some more in the future. Just as any particular sort of thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
Yeah, I mean, we've never claimed that microfinance is a silver bullet for development. You know, poor people need a variety of different services ranging from health and to education to clean drinking water. But financial services is a development intervention unlike many others in that it can be rolled out very cheaply with very little subsidy and has the potential to reach huge numbers of people. We in the West take our financial services for granted. We're used to having safe places to save, access to credit almost instantaneously, insurance against almost any possible risk, and the ability to send money to people in the same country or abroad very easily. But these are things that poor people, about 2.7 billion of those by our estimates worldwide, don't have any access to. So there's huge steps to be taken in reaching those people.
Our guest for this hour, Chris Bold, a microfinance specialist who works on the technology team at CGAP. That's the consultative group to assist the poor in Washington, D.C. If you're interested in finding out more about the organization, the group, the issue, they do indeed have a website. So it's their initials, CGAP, CGAP.org. You can go there and you can find out more. And Chris Bold, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.